Wilkinson is now perfectly in range. Again, Wilkinson in the place. Johnny Wilkinson, he's got it! It's over at last at the fourth attempt. Johnny Wilkinson is on target. England in the lead with only 20 seconds to go.
Looks like it's heading for a draw. Maguire down the line. North.
You're listening to Square Up, Scrum Down, the rugby podcast on URN.
Hello and welcome to Square Up, Scrum Down, the rugby podcast on URN. And this is the first of a new season of podcasts where we'll be bringing you all the latest that's been going on from the world of rugby league and rugby union. We're going to be covering quite a lot on today's show, including the World Cup, the Rugby League World Cup, as well as the internationals that have been taking place in rugby union. But for now, we're going to go over to Alex and Jack, as they've been covering all the latest roundup that's been going on in the Rugby League World Cup.
This is URN Sport. Big win for England against Papua New Guinea.
Yes, very much so. Wayne Bennett's selections have basically just been under fire for the entire Rugby League World Cup. And for the PNG game, he named pretty much the same side that it's been doing the job for the last few weeks. PNG were dealt a bit of a hammer blow very early on as fullback and captain David Mead collided with Luke Gale's shoulder just 90 seconds into the game. He got taken off for a head injury assessment that he didn't come back from, which left bench player Stargroth Armian is filling in at fullback. The only reason I said it because I get to say that name. Two tries very early on to wing star Jermaine McGilvray, everyone's struggling today, were the only points very early on, and Luke Gale's kicking in general play has not been up to his standard in the Super League this season, but I think we should probably get him on goal kicking at this point, because Gareth Widdop just can't, he doesn't have the radar that Luke Gale does at all. Both of his early attempts failing, leaving it 8-0 early on. 31 minutes in, Alex Walmsley barged his way over from close range, following a bit of a scuffle on the ground after Kevin Brown got knocked out just very briefly, and again PNG fullback Stargroth Armian seemed to take exception to this and basically just dove on him on the ground, which got a bit of a scuffle going. This left the gap 14-0 at the break. 53 minutes in, a grubber through from Widdop on a bit of broken field play was pounced on by Ben Curry, giving the Warriton star a clear onto the line. The Cumbles then hit back through danger man Gary Lowe, who scored in the corner, to reduce the gap back to 14, but this very much was England's quarter-final to lose. Three tries in the last 11 minutes iced the game, sent them on the way to the semi-finals. It wasn't a very good game. It was error-riddled from England, 56% completion. We're not going to trouble any of the other three teams if we keep completing like that, but we got the job done. And that's all that we can ask for at the moment, I suppose.
So even with a 36 win, you weren't particularly impressed with the performance.
36-6 win.
36, yeah.
That score was very much inflated, I think. As I say, three tries all converted, I think, in the last 11 minutes of the game. And that's basically what happened there was the PNG defence got tired. And you look at Tonga, you look at Fiji, you look at Australia, they're not going to tire like that. And to say that we were only, 18, 20 points to 6 up, at about 65 minutes, it's a bit of a worry still.
I mean, given that, did you think there was a chance for an upset maybe sent in this game? I mean, before the game and during the game?
Before the game, I absolutely thought there was, and I think if David Mead hadn't got knocked out like 90 seconds into the game, we would have been in for a much tougher time, because he is their captain. He is the leader of them, basically. He's a very inspirational captain, and like, he was so annoyed that he couldn't see out the rest of the game, and he is also an absolute quality fullback. Stargroth Armian is in the second division in Australia. That's where he plays with the PNG club team, and David Mead is an absolutely solid fullback.
just out of interest, I mean, in the Rugby League World Cup, we've had some of these kind of, not weird nations, but quite small nations, ones you wouldn't really associate with Rugby League, like Papua New Guinea, Lebanon, and many others. Why is it particularly Rugby League that seems to kind of attract these countries? I mean, Rugby Union doesn't have quite the same diversity of teams.
Yeah, so what Papua New Guinea, it's the national sport. They've got a lot of, basically you've got a lot of the big Pacific Islanders go over, and they're big, they're athletic, they're strong, they can fill in. There's a PNG player called Wellington Albert, who's, if you go on his Wikipedia page, his preferred positions are listed as prop and wing. So they're very versatile players, and they're very sort of creative ad-lib players. And in Lebanon's case, there's a big Lebanese community living in Sydney, and where they get swept up, the Canterbury Bulldogs are sort of most notable for sort of taking the Lebanese players and getting them through their academy systems, which sort of leads to players back in Lebanon sort of sitting up and taking notes. I think when they made it through to the quarterfinals, the Lebanese president or prime minister tweeted about it. Like, it's become a big thing for them over there, and the Lebanese players in the World Cup have sort of remained very sort of loyal to their heritage, I think.
Just interesting that you said they got a lot of the president tweeting about it in Lebanon, but over here, very little coverage. I mean, England are in a semi-final, might not be playing particularly well, but I think in any other sport, football, even rugby union, it begins seeming much more mainstream kind of press on it. Why do you think that is?
I mean, the main problem really is that rugby league is a sport played along the M62 corridor. I think literally every team in the top flight in the UK in the Super League is either from the M62 corridor, somewhere around there, or is that one team from the south of France that we've somehow managed to get on side. Like, it's not a game played anywhere sort of further south than maybe even here, maybe even in Nottingham. The school system obviously has a lot to do with that. There's a lot of Union has the foothold in schools. And while there have been some absolutely quality players come through from sort of London around that area, Mike McMeekin was born in Basingstoke and he's played a couple of games for England. He's one of the best second rowers that we have. There isn't the interest down there, because everywhere at school you grow up playing Union, you get told this is how rugby works, and you see someone playing it differently and you think, ugh, that's weird. It is a problem that we have. Prince Harry has been made a sort of sponsor of the RFL lately. The England Rugby League team got a tweet out of the Commonwealth, the Kensington Palace, I think, Twitter account, made a point about the England Rugby League team making it through to the quarters. But yeah, it's like you say, like, if the Rugby World Cup was going on now, like in the exact same circumstances in Australia, with all the games being played at the same place at the same times, we wouldn't hear the end of it. All the games would be televised live, probably free on the BBC or like ITV. And here we get the England games at 5 a.m, played in Melbourne, and we get absolutely none of the other games. And the other games are still really interesting games to watch.
The thing is, we are in a semi-final, but we do have a bit of an injury, or a potential injury, bro, in the former Sam Brown, who's suffered
Kevin Brown.
BBC Sports has done me wrong. Who's had a concussion.
Yeah.
Do you think he's going to be a doubt, and will he be a big miss if he can't play?
I think he'll probably play. I watched the video. I literally watched the match this morning, and he got knocked out for about a second or so. Like, you could tell when he got knocked out, he basically fell like a sack of spuds to the floor, but on his way down, he sort of gripped back hold of the ball. It was a very short thing. I think he'll probably play. And it's interesting because he's not been very good at club level, but he seems to be getting the job done at international level. So Luke Gale won the Man of Steel in the Super League this year, like the best player in the Super League, and he was by some distance, but he's not been up to that standard against the other teams the best of the world. Like, and Kevin Brown was one of the best on field in the World Club Challenge way at the beginning of the year, where they were playing against one of the best club sides in the world. It doesn't make any sense. It's incredible.
Indeed. But moving on from the England game to maybe the shock of the quarterfinals, and the fact that Fiji beat New Zealand 4-2 in a very low-scoring affair. I mean, all the points were from kicks, weren't they?
Yes. It was another game that everyone thought would just go only the one way. I mean, me included. I thought, you know, New Zealand had been beaten by Tonga last week. They're going to get the kick up the backside that they need. And it just didn't happen. It was all the points of the game came from penalty goals, as you say. 4-2 victory to the Fijians. David Kidwell is now looking on some very shaky ground as the coach of the Kiwis. David Kidwell, who I think at last year's Four Nations said, rather than saying it was a battle of attrition, said it was a battle of nutrition. That's the level of coaching we're talking here. The side that won the World Cup in 2008 is just a distant memory. It was a passionless display, basically. Mm. And this is the problem, is there was an interview from Adam Blair, New Zealand captain, loose forward, the guy who's supposed to be leading these people. He was chewing gum and talking quite candidly about, like, yeah, we lost, it's a problem, we're building to something. Adam, you're playing in a World Cup, what are you building to? You're building your ranking so it's a bigger number in the world. That's what you're building at the moment. This will be the first World Cup ever that a tier one nation has not made it through to the semis. It was a shocking game from the Kiwis, frankly.
I mean, yeah, was it more the Kiwis playing badly, or was it also Fiji playing well?
Fiji absolutely stood up, but like, as much as I do have a go, especially on a club level, about commentators saying that the team that's supposed to win played badly rather than the team that's not playing well, there are a lot of problems in New Zealand Rugby League at the moment. The fact is that most of the Kiwi players also all play for the same club team, the New Zealand Warriors, and it's just, and that, like, so you think, oh my god, they've got the entire New Zealand team basically at their disposal, they must be really good. No, they've missed the finals for the last like 5-6 years, and they just have a massive culture problem. That what they need is a hard task. David Kidwell is not a good coach. He's not the right coach for them. They need a hard taskmaster who's going to get the best out of them.
Do you think that David Kidwell will leave then?
I think he'll lose his job, yeah.
Yeah.
That he has overseen, last year in the Four Nations, he oversaw the first time a Tier 2 nation took a point off a Tier 1 nation in basically international rugby league history, when Scotland drew 18-all in Workington with New Zealand. And now he's overseen the first time a Tier 2 nation has beaten a Tier 1 nation, and the first time a Tier 1 nation hasn't made it through to the semis. It's one of the most disastrous reigns at the head of an international rugby league team I've ever seen. It's ridiculous. And if he is still with a job the next time New Zealand play with an international game, someone on that board is not doing their job.
Yeah. But moving on to slightly brighter things, I mean, Fiji's defence are incredible.
Fiji played their absolute socks off. You can, like, they play with so much passion. They really do, like, this is the thing, like, I say New Zealand don't buy into a culture, whereas Fiji, like, it's a very cultural place, very spiritual place. There's a lot of, like, hymns go on. They sing a hymn before every game. And all the players have bought into the culture and believe in what they're doing. And that's just something that New Zealand don't do. And that is massively to Fiji's credit.
It's quite refreshing to see this, given the amount of money that's in sport nowadays. Yeah. A lot of people kind of see this kind of cash hungry rather than playing for the love of the game. Is it good to see this kind of culture?
This is what has happened with the sort of high-profile defections happening before the World Cup. Like, as you say, it's a very cash-hungry game, and, like, yeah, the thing is, these players, they're going to play until they're maybe 35, if they're, like, a big forward. But what's happened is, you get people like Jason Tamalolo and Andrew Fafita, who would otherwise be receiving $20,000 or $30,000 a game to play in this World Cup for Australia and New Zealand, have defected to Tonga, have defected to the smaller nations, where they get $30 a day spending money, and that's it. Like, it's this World Cup, if anything, has shown that, like, it's been an incredible sort of leveller, as far as I'm concerned. I really hope this kind of thing continues, because as a sport, rugby league can't afford to have the same three teams consistently in every single semi-final series. It's just not good for the game.
Yeah, moving on to one of the other kind of island nations, Tonga.
Yes.
They were a bit of a fright by Lebanon, wasn't it? Quite a close game.
They very much were. It was
24-22.
It was a game that a lot of people, again, saw only going the one way. But despite letting in the first try to Tui Lolahia, Lebanon then scored through their own centre, Adam Dwehi, to level things at 6-6 with 10 minutes to go, with 10 minutes played even. David Fusatu has been scoring basically at will, so he and Will Hopewati stretched things out to 16 points to 6 with sort of 20 minutes to go, 20 minutes gone. Fusatu got his double on the 33rd, and then Lebanon produced one of the most incredible tries I've ever seen in my life to leave things at 22-16 at the break. Tonga decided to take the margin to 8 at 53 minutes with a Ata Hingano penalty goal, and then it was reduced back to 2 after centre Abbas Miski got his second of the day. It ended 24-22, which was a it was a shock how close that was, because Tonga have been steamrolling everyone else. But again, the Cedars, the Lebanese team, have really again bought into a culture. They've bought into what it means, the pride and the spirit of playing for that jersey.
Would you say they've surpassed kind of expectations getting this far?
Oh, absolutely. Lebanon have, like, everyone, the thing is, everyone expected Tonga to get to this point. They've got an absolutely class back line. They've got one of the biggest, scariest forward packs I've ever seen in my life. No one gave Lebanon a chance. Like, no one really saw them doing anything like as well. They've been the real surprise packet. And a lot of these Lebanese players who play part-time, they're not professional players. Some of them have taken, like, big financial hits going away from work to play in the World Cup for a month or two. A lot of them have put themselves very, very squarely in a lot of big teams' shop windows as possible players for the future. One of their wingers has been snapped up by the Penrith Panthers, probably to play second grade, probably just a depth signing. But this is what the World Cup does. It puts players in shop windows. It's the same in any sport, I suppose. And Lebanon have done an absolutely outstanding job of doing that.
And finally moving on to the final quarter-final in Australia dismantled Samoa,
yeah,
didn't they?
It was not a pretty game. Like, I'm generally a bit of a Samoa fan. They play Pacific Test between Samoa and Tonga every now and again, and I always support Samoa because I love them. It was only ever going to go one way, really. The Kangaroos put an absolute clinic. Valentine Holmes became the first person to score 4 tries in a World Cup match since his own back row away, Graham, did it about 3 weeks ago. He then became the first player ever to score 5 tries in a single World Cup game. A double to stand-off Michael Morgan added to an absolute blowout 46-0 scoreline. There's not much you can say about it, really. Valentine Holmes, what a player. He should be on the wing. Like, that's his position. He's trying to set himself as a fullback at club level, but he could be one of the best wingers in the world, and I think he's trying to put too much on his own plate.
And surely Australia must be favourites now.
Oh, absolutely. They've been favourites since the tournament started. They've been on, like, the shortest odds to make the final, win the final. You can't see it going any other way. I'd like to see... They've now got Fiji in the semi-final. We've got Tonga. Honestly, I can see it being a Tonga-Australia final. As much as I don't want to say it, I think Tonga are going to put an absolute frightener on us.
This is URN Sport.
So that was Alex and Jack there with the latest that's been going on in the Rugby League World Cup. Full update there, and if you want to hear more of a quick succinct one, then you can tune into our Tuesday Sports Show, where we'll be giving you the small highlights package as to what's been going on. But for now, we're going to move things along and talk about everything that's been going on in rugby union. I'm joined here in the studio with Tom, Matt and Ollie, and I'm going to now throw it over to the guys, as they're going to be running through with you all the latest that's been going on in the world of rugby union.
So guys, welcome to the first podcast. There's been a lot going on in the world of rugby union, so where should we start, really? Probably last weekend's international fixtures certainly have a lot of attention, some exciting games in there. What do we make of England's performance, first of all?
Well, I watched England's performance from the ideal punditry position of the Bath Student Union bar. And it was a bit of a scrappy game for the first 70 minutes. Very, very close, very tight. You always felt it could go either way. But England really ran away with it in the last 10 minutes with some excellent play from Danny Kerr, who was phenomenal off the bench. Really livened England's game up and showed what they might be missing in that area. And really putting the pressure on Ben Youngs to be the first choice scrum half, in my opinion. So it was looking a bit dead for England, if I'm honest. They lacked the intensity, but I think Kerr made such a difference to them. And then some really nice play from the likes of Elliot Daly and Johnny May to help us finish the tries off.
Yeah, definitely. I think he talked a lot about that. Eddie Jones did as well, over the Six Nations and the summer tour last year against Australia, about the importance of having not just people starting the game, but also the bench players, as he calls them, the finishers, who are going to come into the game and really sort of, you know, take things up a notch. And, you know, that's where England have their strength over Australia, the sort of the depth that we have to bring on players, as you say, like Kerr and Jamie George from the bench, who are, you know, top quality players as well. That's where we sort of ran away with it in the last 15 or so, simply because we outclassed them and had better depth and strength all across the squad, really.
Yeah. That being said, though, I think the scoreline definitely flatters us. I mean, I didn't actually catch the whole game. I only caught the highlights. So when I actually saw the scoreline, I expected the win to be fairly comfortable, but in reality it was anything but that. Like you said, it wasn't until we brought on all those replacements, and it wasn't until the last 10 minutes where we were really pulled away from it. And to be honest, I think there was a few contentious decisions in the game. Whether or not the referee made the direct decision in these is questionable, and I think England were lucky in the sense that all those calls did go their way.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, we were as a house, we were watching it and we were very split. I thought that it was for, I think it was England's first try, where it was kicked down and Beale sort of thinks it's going out, and the ball obviously being, you know, classic rugby ball, just sort of stays in. I actually thought it did touch the line. There was one angle which I thought it was pretty, by a centimetre or two was on the line, and but there was no clear evidence, and they had to go with it. I think Australia would have felt pretty hard done by. There were some 50-50 calls. Maybe if it was you know, down in Brisbane or something, then obviously they would have gone the other way. But
I think you've got to think, how many times in English rugby and even English sports have we had 50-50 calls go against us over the years?
Yeah, that's
it's
true.
It swings in roundabouts. We'll get our share of the calls. We had a bit of luck. I think we were definitely the better team. I don't think it was the best rugby that either side has played, but we were definitely a better team, and both teams will be looking to improve on that performance. And yes, we did get a few 50-50 calls, but at the end of the day, you have to roll with what you're given, and England made the most of their advantage. Australia seemed to get a bit fed up and angry rather than really looking to kick on, so I think that they don't really have anybody to blame apart from themselves, and they didn't defend very well in the last 10 minutes and really let the floodgates open for England.
Yeah, they did. I think they managed the game better overall as well. You've got that, you know, you've got Beale, who is a good player, but the quality that we've got at, you know, 10 and 12, having Ford and Fowle, their game management is so good at the moment. I think that's, you know, just as important as having the, you know, the players we've got out wide and the strength in the forwards, and that axis in the middle is crucial to England's success. But it was a good match as well for Scotland, wasn't it? It was a shame in the end, but they put up an incredible game against New Zealand. Really, took it all down. Stuart Hogg nearly went over in the end to score a match-winning try. So they've never beaten the All Blacks. So there's a lot of pain around Murrayfield. But it was really a good game as well.
Absolutely. I mean, the Scots are renowned for sort of playing very well and then losing valiantly, and then they did it again here. So I think there's been so much progress in Scottish rugby over the last few years, to come from where they were to I think they came third or second in the Six Nations.
It's just been
a phenomenal turnaround. They did themselves proud. It was a shame that they couldn't quite get a win, which would have been such a brilliant result, not just for Scotland but for world rugby, to really shake things up and put New Zealand under pressure. So it would be nice to see that happen, but I'm sure they'll get another chance. They've had big wins before. I'm sure I'll have them again.
Yeah, I mean, I've been impressed by Scotland for a couple of years now, ever since that result against Australia in the World Cup quarter final, where they were desperately unlucky to lose. Again, going back to those contentious decisions, they had a dodgy one there, and if it hadn't been for that dodgy refereeing call, then they could have been in the World Cup semi-finals. So I've been impressed with them ever since then, but still, this result against New Zealand even shocked me, because in my opinion at least, and I think probably in most people's opinions, New Zealand are by far and away still the best team in the world. It wasn't really like they played a weakened team. They still had a lot of their superstars out there, the likes of Beauden Barrett, Damian McKenzie, who are probably the two best players in the world at the minute. So even though they did lose, I mean, they probably put up a lot better fight than a lot of other nations would have done.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the importance of sort of Vern Cotter's role after the match, Stuart Hogg was talking about his role in sort of, you know, remoulding and giving sort of Scottish rugby a new identity. And I think obviously that is you can see it clearly instilled across all of the players. They know, you know, what they're fighting for. They just lack that sort of the finishing edge, that sort of final third, just to get over the line. And you have it all the time. The best teams, there are only some teams in world rugby that you can see spending 10 minutes in someone's 22 and actually coming away with a decent point return from it. Well, that's a try or even a penalty, and the only teams you can see doing that are England and New Zealand, sort of consistently. And I think that's what Scotland are just lacking. They can't always, you know, finish it and put points on the board. But it's very encouraging. It's very pleasing to see New Zealand being challenging, because 2015 and 2016 they were unchallenged. I mean, they didn't play England, but they were certainly unchallenged in that regard. It was a mixed weekend for Wales and Ireland as well.
Yeah, I mean, Wales, eventually they got the win over Georgia, but I think it was much closer than everyone was expecting and what Wales would have wanted it to be. 13-6 win for them. I mean, it was a pretty poor performance on the whole from Wales. They've slipped their standards the last couple of years. Some of their players have perhaps been getting on a bit, like the likes of Warburton and Cope being suffering from more injuries. And they've been lacking a bit of quality. There's a bit of confusion about set pieces in the match with the refereeing, and that probably didn't help Wales. But at the end of the day, they were it was a very scrappy game, even scrappy than the England match, and Wales just needed to show a bit more class, and I think they were lacking in that department, and they have been for some time now, sadly.
Yeah, definitely. They've sort of struggled. They've always been attributed with Warren Ball, but as you say, the players have gone old, players like Jamie Roberts and stuff, and he's still playing, but he's not sort of, you know, playing as well as he was, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, and when the Wales team was sort of really effective under that sort of under Gatland, and they haven't quite managed to keep their momentum the last couple of years as England and Ireland have sort of, you know, started to play much better rugby. Obviously we've got the games this weekend as well, so whether we'll see a change in fortunes this weekend or not. Wales are at home to New Zealand, so how do we think they're going to get on there then?
I think New Zealand are going to demolish Wales based on the performance.
Yeah.
New Zealand won't be happy with their performance against Scotland, so they'll be wanting to really up their levels after that match. Wales will be disappointed, but I don't think they'll be able to do anything about their performance. I don't think they've got the class. Yeah, I would be looking at quite a big scoreline, actually. I think that Wales are on the low, New Zealand are hungry. It's going to be a bad loss for Wales, in my mm-hmm. considered opinion.
Yeah, well, I mean, I agree with what Matt was saying. I do think Wales will probably play a lot better than they did last week. I mean, they did rest a lot of their big names last week against Georgia. It wasn't exactly their strongest 15. That being said, yeah, I can see this being a very, very convincing scoreline for New Zealand. I think they'll come back fighting a lot stronger than they did against Scotland. I think they probably recognised that they weren't clinical enough and didn't play to the best of their ability. And I think what you normally tend to see with All Black sides is after they suffer, I mean, it wasn't exactly a bad result, they still won, but if when they sort of have a less than average performance, they do seem to come back fighting a lot stronger. So yeah, I wouldn't be surprised to see a very, very large New Zealand win here.
Yeah, I mean, the All Blacks captain Kieran Reid has been brought out of the match with a sore back, but the thing about the All Black strength and depth is that Luke Whitelock, who's coming in from, is not exactly a bad player. Their strength and depth is phenomenal. I think the All Blacks second or third team will probably be better than most first teams.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I was actually just going to touch on sort of the conveyor belt of talent that New Zealand seem to have. Mm-hmm. Like, the problem with teams like Australia recently has been that the reason they've suffered a fall from grace is a lot of their more experienced players have seemingly retired at the same time, and they haven't been able mm-hmm. to find replacements for them. Whereas New Zealand, when some of their big names have retired, the likes of Richie McCaw, they've been able to replace them straight away with the likes of Sam Kane. And Julian Saave, who's New Zealand's top try scorer of all time, has now been dropped for Rico Ioane, who's only 20 years of age and is now nominated for World Rugby Player of the Year. So yeah, the strength and depth that they've got is honestly unbelievable, and suggests that they could still be the best team in the world for years and years to come.
I think what New Zealand have done well always is they're never afraid to move a player on when they think they've gone past their best, when they're getting a bit too old. I mean, admittedly, that Richard McCaw played out of his career, but that's because he was still at such a high level. Yeah. They're very willing to sacrifice older, more experienced players for younger players who they think have got much more potential or in better form. I think that's that ruthless attitude means they're one of the best teams in the world. Whereas teams like Wales perhaps are more willing to stick with what they know, with the likes of Warburton and Coburn, rather try a younger and perhaps more untested player, which is one of the reasons why New Zealand have dominated world rugby for so long.
Yeah, that's the thing, that it is going to be a tough game for them. Obviously Wales will have home advantage, but you know, it doesn't seem to affect teams like New Zealand at times. And then there, I mean, that should be an entertaining game, hopefully. England have a what would be, you'd presume, rather formality win over Samoa, and Ireland are playing Argentina as well. But the other game that really I think will be a very good one is Scotland Australia as well. I'm really looking forward to that one. That one's on 2:30 at Saturday, and that should be a really close game. If Scotland sort of play anything like they did last week against New Zealand, obviously if Hogg's, you know, on the exceptional form that he was last weekend, then it will. I don't see why Scotland shouldn't come away with a big and you know, very famous victory over Australia, to be honest.
It's a really close contest, isn't it? I think you'd probably put Scotland as perhaps just edging it as favourites, potentially, from the way that the two teams have been playing over the last few weeks.
Yeah, that's true as well. I mean, you look at Scotland, their ability to move the ball now should really trouble Australia. And even though Australia do have, you know, some good wide players, they're not, you know, sort of Flower and such. They're still lacking a little bit of direction. I don't know what their style of attack is. They didn't get a try against England. Obviously, there were some close calls, but I sort of feel they're going to struggle again, really. Especially if Murrayfield is up for it as much as they were last week as well. Rather a vociferous crowd. England against Samoa as well. Nothing you'd expect England to get the win, but there have been a few decisions this week about team selection, giving some new players some goes as well. So what do we think of Hartley's omission from the squad?
I think it's a logical choice because Jamie George is a much younger man and he's seen as the successor to Hartley in the long term. So I think it makes sense to blood him and give him a start, see how he goes. A lot of people saying he's already better than Hartley. Mm. And I think his line out I'm not sure about the line out with. I think Hartley's really on that much more than George. But I think it'll be interesting to see how he goes. He obviously wants opportunities. He's been waiting for so long in the wings. Okay, coming on as a sub, he will want to be the first choice man. It depends on how he deals with the pressure. If he performs really well, it could be interesting to see how Eddie Jones goes from there, to see if he keeps with Jamie George as his starter and perhaps Hartley sort of the squad captain, and then he needs like a game captain.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree with the public perception that Jamie George probably is a better player than Dylan Hartley now, and he definitely is the long term replacement. I think that's obvious judging by the fact that he actually started for the Lions. But I don't think we should really read that much into Dylan Hartley being dropped. I mean, at the end of the day, we are playing Samoa, and no disrespect to them, but they're not in the same calibre of the likes of New Zealand, Australia, South Africa. And I think that's why Eddie Jones has made some of these decisions. So yeah, although I think Jamie George is obviously the long-term replacement, I wouldn't read much into this the decision to drop Dylan Hartley.
Yeah, I think Hartley's obviously he feels that he has a lot of leadership, clearly, Jones, and he sort of feels that he offers that to the squad. But I think I personally really like Jamie George. I think in the loose, you know, he just offers a lot more options, sort of in open play as well, than Hartley. He seems more comfortable either putting ball to boot or just generally playing off the slips, really. But it'll be interesting as well to see. I think it's Lozowski starting at centre as well, so it'll be interesting to see how he gets on. Obviously the Saris player is a quality player, but he just unfortunately isn't as good as Ford and Fowler, really, so he must be thinking, he must be really excited to try and grab the ball by the horns, really, and sort of show Jones, not only the depth that we've got, but also why he should be pushing for a starting role against sort of tier one sides as well.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, also Sam Simmons coming in at number 8 for his debut, the Exeter man who had such a good season when Exeter won the Premiership, and a very deserved call-up, I would say. I think Eddie Jones taking the right approach to this, giving people the chance to prove themselves. He wants to be on the same level as New Zealand with that strength and depth to be able to become the best in the world. And the only way you can do that is through giving people opportunities. And yes, Samoa probably aren't quite as good as Australia or South Africa or New Zealand, but they are still a decent team. They were still if they were in the Six Nations, they would definitely be competing for the mid spots. So I think it will still be a decent game. And Danny Kerr's also starting at scrum half now. I wonder if that's a bit more of an interesting move, because he might be being told if you have a few good games here at first choice scrum half, you could be getting on ahead of Ben Youngs now. So that's a really interesting move from Hartley. Jones. But I mean, Eddie Jones said that if they're playing New Zealand, then Dylan Hartley would 100% be his first choice hooker. So he's made it very clear that this is just a chance to give Jamie George some more game time, rather than to definitively say he's going to be the next first time hooker.
Yeah, with regards to Lozowski, as you were talking about, Tom, I'm also very interested to see how he plays, because I haven't really been his biggest fan. I think he was fairly overrated at Saracens. I think he was probably brought into the England squad too early, but I think he came off the bench against Argentina and he really impressed me in that sense. So I'm very interested to see how he plays. I think we've got, is it Piers Francis on the bench as well, who's another interesting one. He's joined Northampton Saints recently, and he's actually been a player who's spent a lot of his trade in the Southern Hemisphere playing for the Blues. So it's very interesting to see how he plays. I think he could potentially be an option against New Zealand, maybe, having played for a New Zealand club side and played a lot against a lot of those players before. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how both of them fare, because I can't see both of them staying in the England squad long term. I think there might be one place up for grabs between the two of them, so yeah, interesting to see which one takes that position.
Do you think we would challenge New Zealand more if we had players like Francis playing in the Southern Hemisphere more? Do you think that would help us to adapt to their game style more?
Potentially. I mean, you saw it with Haskell when he went to, I think it was the Highlanders, maybe one of the New Zealand sides, and he did some time in Japan as well, I think. The quality of the rugby there is certainly more sort of standard, like that. It's a very high quality, but as well, I think it is very important as well for the development of a national side if you do still have players playing, you know, within sort of the same, within the home counties. Obviously, they've, some of them have rules about it which are probably going to be relaxed at some point in the next sort of 5 to 10 years, because quite a few of Scotland's players want to, you know, go and play in the Premiership, or, you know, they move to France or something. And the Scottish Union is incredibly against that. I think it would challenge them to a bit, and obviously it would make them... But at the same time, like, I think that the results that we've had recently show that English rugby is in a very, very good place as well. So I wouldn't say that there's a need for a sort of a mass exodus. I think that if you then suddenly had all of these top quality players then moving abroad, I think that might actually be quite damaging to the domestic game.
Yeah, actually, I was just about to say that, actually, Tom. I completely agree. I think even though moving abroad could potentially enhance some of these players' developments, if it was the case that all these players could do that and still get picked for England, I think a lot more of them would do, and that would sort of weaken English domestic rugby, which seems to be getting quite a lot stronger in recent years since England have changed these rules. I mean, it is annoying in the sense that some great players out there, the likes of Stephen Armitage, who's been playing for too long, I mean, he's probably a bit past it now, but I think a couple of seasons ago he was one of the best players in the world, but these eligibility rules sort of prevented him from playing, and that was annoying. I think in the sense of going abroad, I think it'd probably be better for sort of younger players for their development. Yeah. Maybe not sort of players pushing for the England squad at that stage, but a lot of these younger players. I think there's a player for Saracens, a winger called Nathan Earle, who was part of England under-20s winning World Cup winning squad a few years ago, and he couldn't really sort of get a game at Saracens, and he actually went off and played for Canterbury in the ITM Cup a couple of seasons ago, and finished as the top try scorer in the ITM Cup, and he's come back a much better player. I think he made his debut for England as a result in the autumn of last year, and actually scored a couple of tries. So in that sense, it appears good for young players' development. So yeah, I think that's probably what I suggest, sort of push the younger players to go abroad maybe, but those older players sort of pushing for their England places to stay put in England.
Yeah,
it's all about striking that balance, isn't it, really? You want, obviously, the quality of rugby in England to remain strong, but you also want the players to gain the experience that would help them along the way for internationals. So I think if we can find that balance, then perhaps we'll be looking at challenging New Zealand. I mean, I'd say England are clearly the second best team in the world right now.
Definitely
ahead of Australia and South Africa. We proved that by winning over them several times in a row. It's just New Zealand are the team left we need to beat consistently, and once we can do that, we'll be the best team in the world. And it's all about, I think Eddie Jones is all about working towards that.
Yeah, and that's the clash, obviously, that everybody's wanted now for quite a while. You know, because there was when we nearly set the record for the longest unbeaten streak, there was the argument, especially from some of the like New Zealand press as well, oh well, you know, you haven't played New Zealand, so you know this streak means nothing because you haven't played them beaten the best team in the world, which isn't quite what a streak is. And then it was pointed out to them also New Zealand haven't actually played England as well, and that going across to Twickenham would also be a very tough test for them, especially with England, you know, whitewashing the Aussies 3-0, you know, abroad in Australia. That was a huge statement of intent from the English team. And I sort of feel that now England rugby is at such a good place that if we were playing them, I think it would be a very, very close game indeed. I don't think New Zealand, I think they lost to Brisbane in the last Bledisloe Cup.
Yeah, they did.
And obviously they had a close game against Scotland as well, and obviously these are, you know, only a couple of results. And New Zealand do still have a huge amount of quality. But, you know, what are your thoughts on whether or not, you know, on how close that game would be? And do you think it would happen? I think it is 29. I presume it would be the World Cup, will be the next. Or is it next year we're playing? I think it's 2018.
It's next autumn.
We've got the Ultimate Internationals next year, haven't we?
Yeah, it's next autumn, I think.
So that would be a very big game. Very, very big game indeed. Yeah, how do you think it's going to go?
I certainly think it's going to be a lot closer than it would have been a couple of years ago. I think the reason why Eddie Jones perhaps didn't read that much into this streak and didn't get ahead of himself is because he knew deep down that if we did play New Zealand, we wouldn't be able to challenge them. That's perhaps why we've waited this long to arrange a fixture. I don't actually know if Eddie Jones has any part in organising these fixtures or if it's just the RFU. But yeah, I think that could potentially be the reason why we've waited this long. I think it would be a close game, but I think you sort of have to look at both 15s on paper and think which England players would get into that New Zealand starting 15. And to be completely honest with you, I think Maro Itoje replacing Sam Whitelock is probably the only thing that I could do. And yeah. I mean, you could even argue against that, to be completely honest with you. So in that sense, I think New Zealand are obviously still going to be the stronger team, but England are going to be closer to beating them than they have been, or yeah, the closest to beating them they have been since that victory in 2012.
Yeah, and obviously the sort of the there are a lot of comparisons being made with the England team now as the one that went on to win the World Cup in 2003, because they picked up a couple. They picked up the Grand Slam, Six Nations, and obviously then sort of Clive Woodward was building them up for the 2003 World Cup. And they went, I think there was, it was either in 2001, I think, or maybe early in 2003, went across and beat New Zealand in New Zealand itself. And that was obviously a huge statement of intent then. And by that point, England were the best team in the world. So obviously what England fans are looking for is that same progression now. It's that same sort of feeling that, yeah, you know, by the time the next World Cup rolls around, we're not going to get knocked out of the group stage as we did last time, rather embarrassingly, and that we're going to go on and get to the, you know, get to the semi, get to the final, and hopefully win the competition. Do you think that is a realistic aim, and is it a good comparison to make?
It's absolutely a realistic aim. That's the only aim we can have now, considering the position we've been in. I mean, I think we won 21 out of 22 of Jones' games.
Yeah.
So you can't go on that sort of form without thinking, oh, we'll settle for the quarterfinal. You know, we've got to aim to win this, to win the World Cup. That's the ultimate goal. I think Jones made it very clear that's what he wants to do with England, and I think they're capable of it. I think they've got the ability in the squad. It's not about finding that mental edge that winners have, and it's about developing that over these games. I think the Australian game is a good example of that. You know, they it was tight for the first 70 minutes, and then they showed their class and mental edge to close it out. And if England can keep on producing results like that, then I think it's there's no reason why they can't win the World Cup.
Yeah, but making comparisons with that amazing team of 2003, around that time, the England team sort of had the perfect development. They won the Six Nations and Grand Slam in the years prior to the World Cup, and by the time the World Cup rolled around, they had a squad of players who had sort of played a lot together. There weren't that many new players, not many inexperienced players, and they sort of knew their best 15 on paper. So I think it's key that England sort of know their best team and have a bunch of experienced players by the time the World Cup does roll around, which means that the likes of Lazowski, Sam Simmons, this is the time for them to press their claim, because I don't really want to see that many more players to, sort of embedded into the England team in the sort of after this sort of stage.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right to say that we need to find out what our best team is relatively soon. There's still positions up in the air. I think that the hooker position is obviously, there's a strong contest there. But in some ways, that's healthy to have two very good hookers competing for the place. And we're, I mean, either of them are a pretty good option, to be honest. So that's it's a sort of blessing, and it's also a curse. It's
definitely. I think as well, you'll see, by the time it rolls around, I reckon it'll go to George. I think there's more competition in the second row. I think that's a huge area. You know, we've got Court. You've got such good, you know, strength and depth. Like, who do you pick as?
I mean,
and
then obviously Laws, Itoje, there's so many options.
Yeah, and even George Cruz as well.
George Cruz, of course. I mean, to be honest, the thing is, you're not dissatisfied with any of them.
No.
Because they're all really good, so...
Well, I'm a Wasps fan, so I'm a big Launchbury fan as well. I'm glad that he's starting this
well, I mean,
this weekend.
I'm an Exeter fan, but I'm a big Itoje fan. I think he's a really excellent player, and I will always push for him to start.
Yeah, to be completely honest with you, in terms of second row, it's quite clearly our strongest position. I mean, I honestly wouldn't have a problem whether it was Laws, Itoje, Launchbury, any of them, to be completely honest. The one thing that I don't want to happen is the same thing that happened at the 2015 World Cup, where we sort of just integrate these new players at the last minute, the likes of Sam Burgess, who then came in and played centre despite not even playing there for his club.
Yeah.
And in one sense, I'm a bit scared. I feel like Eddie Jones is the sort of person to make sort of a risky call like that.
Yeah.
That sort of thing scares me. I just hope that all the progress that we've made at the minute isn't undone at the last minute by stupid decisions like that.
Yeah, I think Burgess was a classic example of the difference between, you know, backs converting from rugby league, and you've got Jason Robinson who converted, Lottie Takiri, you know, countless, you know, ones who've come across, and Denny Solomona, who's been playing incredibly well as well recently. So you've got backs who come across and they're basically doing the same thing. However, converting from a forward in rugby league to rugby union is a very different kettle of fish entirely. And just a very, very brief thing on the I think it's got time maybe just as well for a brief look at the Premiership as well. It's been a mixed start to the campaign. No team's really yet put a massive stamp on it. Obviously, the defending champions Exeter have started okay, and Wasps had a bit of a shaky start to the season, but they're slowly climbing the table. Can you see anybody coming out on the top of the table or putting a stamp on it by Christmas?
I think that Exeter are looking... I mean, it's the usual suspects, of course, but... I mean, I'd say the London Irish and Worcester, I mean, they look distinctly poor compared to the rest of the teams when you look at, and look at their games. My friend Zach informs me that Bath are going to win the Premiership. He's told me this. he must be true. I think Bath are looking strong, actually. I've seen a couple of their games on TV, and they have looked very certain in their attack and in their defence, and I think that they'll really push this season.
Yeah.
And it could be the year for Bath. They've been waiting for a long time and you never know.
That is true.
Yeah, I think the Premiership this year, though, has actually been quite refreshing in the sense that I think there's quite a lot of teams in the mix this year. In recent seasons, it's sort of been Exeter, Saracens, Wasps last season sort of running away with it. But I think the standard of the teams is a lot closer this year. Wasps obviously aren't having the same success that they were last year. And
yeah.
My sort of outside bet to do very well this season would be Harlequins.
Okay.
I've watched a few of their games this season and I've been incredibly impressed by the new fly half Marcus Smith, who's only 18 years of age, but I think he's the top point scorer in the Premiership at the minute. He's got an absolutely unbelievable step. I wouldn't be surprised at all to see him be the sort of replacement for Ford in a couple of years' time. Okay. I think Ford's got there's a lot more pressure on Ford for his position in the England side at the minute, especially if Smith carries on playing like this. I've been very, very impressed with Harlequins this season. I think they play very good rugby, and yeah, I wouldn't be surprised to see them challenged by the end of the season.
Yeah, definitely. So I think I'm hoping that Watson still come out on top, but yeah, obviously it is going to be a very, very competitive year in total for both the Premiership and obviously the increasing competitiveness that we get in the international fixtures as well. So I think that's just about us done for our first episode of Square Up, Scrum Down. I'll remember that by the time we do the 50th, but not by the first, I'm afraid. So thanks to everybody for coming down and getting this done. We hope you enjoyed it.
Thank you very much then all for listening, and we'll be back hopefully within the next fortnight to bring you the latest update from everything that's been going on in the world of rugby, both league and union.
This is URN Sport.